Hi, this is my story. Women of science have all the answers. Rebecca is a metaphor. Correction, Rebecca is a meteor. See page 156, paragraph 2 of her book, the one the critic called a spellbinding, fire-breathing work of first fiction. We are three meteors streaking the winter night sky. I am also a metaphor, a meteor. Anna, the third meteor metaphor, has her own view of the solar system as it pertains to our relationship and says that Rebecca is Venus and we are her twin moons. This metaphor is less about comparing Rebecca to Venus, goddess of beauty, than about the fact that Anna thinks Venus is the only planet in the solar system with two moons, but she is not 100% on this. Anna writes children's books about hitchhiking rabbits and does not mind being vague. I am a science writer. I ask scientists circuitous questions and rephrase their answers for readers. And so, the natural world is the one I will claim. Anna is the earth, fertile and yielding. Rebecca, you saw this coming, yes? Rebecca is the sun. I am not a meteor, not a twin, but our own moon, orbiting one and reflecting without end the light of the other. Here is an example of a metaphor at work. Anna is with Rebecca in Charlotte, North Carolina. I am in an airport lounge in Queens, New York. I told them that I was obligated to share my views on animal cloning with important, unnamed people. They have no reason to suspect I am lying and let it pass. Really, what I want is for Anna to arrive first, to perform the first survey, to establish the lead. Here is the metaphor. I want Anna to be the first boat to hit the shore at Normandy. No. Anna is my best friend. Metaphors in which she is killed by Nazis should be avoided. But yes, I saw Saving Private Ryan. There was no glory at the back of the gunboats, but glory cannot shield against, say, grenades. Grenades, in this metaphor, represent the randomly detonating effects of Rebecca's mental illness or drug addiction or drama making or book research or whatever it is. There are three magazine stands within a 5-minute walk at my gate, and I patrol them at intervals, awaiting the last flight of the day from New York to Charlotte, comparing the selection of chocolate and sodas and inflatable neck pillows. At the smallest, a kitchenette of a newsstand, there is a rack of books, most of which I recognize from the television movies that they became. I stop at the most familiar, with the name I know so well embossed in metallic ink, and run my hand across the letters. A woman in a Statue of Liberty t-shirt touches my arm. Is that good? I heard that was good, she says. I don't know, I say. I haven't read it. I have a 5-hour flight ahead of me, she says, and nothing to read but an old issue of Cosmo. I want to be helpful, and I want to be acknowledged. I'm sure it is, I say. I know the writer. You do? She places her other hand on my other arm, and it looks like we are about to waltz. I am all she can see at the moment. Really? Rebecca Shanner, I say, pointing to the name. She's my best friend from high school. Are you still close? I know this intimacy, this immediate intimacy of airports and charity walkathons. We talked every day for high school and college, I say, but I haven't seen her for about a year. This is not what she was hoping for. Oh, she says. But I'm going right now to visit her. I am sending this poor woman on a roller coaster of emotion. Really? For real? We are friends again. I'm going to test you, she says, pulling another copy of the book from the rack and turning it over. What's her hometown? It's Naugawick, I say. No, she says, placing the book back on the rack. She looks alert, aware, alive to the possibility that she is being scammed by an airport con artist. It is, I say, turning my own copy over. It says Charlotte, right? We both look, and it does. We're from Charlotte, I say. Naugawick is right outside. She looks at me funny, closely, unsure. Are you famous? She says. Are you a writer like she is? No, I say, not like she is. Her nose is hovering inches away from mine. Have you ever been on Oprah? I laugh, take a step back. No, I say, I haven't. I'm going to buy this book, she says, as I am walking backwards away from her. You tell your friend that her story better be worth $8.50. I will, I say, I will. It is near midnight by the time I land in Charlotte, and after two by the time I rent a car and find the airport Radisson. Rebecca greets me at the door, pulling me by the elbow into the dark space. "Are you so excited?" she says. "It's just like high school." "Just like high school," I say, "except we're 10 years older." Her skin looks like a desert wash, pale and cracked, and she has cut her long black hair into a sort of abbreviated mullet, hacked short at the ears and long on top. Anna and I had decided that Mrs. Shanner was overreacting. She is described in the book as a dry firecracker in a stack of matches, one of Rebecca's less elegant metaphors, I think. But maybe she's right. Maybe there is more to this than play acting. Rebecca steps in front of a window, and in the glow of the parking light sulfur lights, her face glows. "Are you wearing a mask?" I say. Body Shop Blue Corn," she says. "Isn't that your favorite? Don't you think you should take it off before you go to sleep?" "I like it better on," Rebecca says. "It makes me feel very safe." "It's weird," I say, and she purses her lips, but I ignore it. "Where's Anna?" "She's down at the bar. She wanted me to wait here for you." "Oh, Anna, it is clear what she is doing, leaving Rebecca here to be discovered on her own like a sample in a petri dish without Anna's analysis or prejudice." "I'm going to find her," I say. Anna looks lonesome at the bar. For 6 years now, she has been the calm center of a squall of kids and dogs and rabbits and nannies, and without them, she seems frail, unstable, as if the center cannot hold. "You're here," she says, sucking the last drops of what appears to be a margarita through a straw. "Why are we at a hotel?" I say. "I thought we were going to her apartment." "Why? Because she doesn't have an apartment. She doesn't live there anymore because she lives in a storage unit." "What? Do they make storage units for sleeping?" "It's probably an underground box with rats. She sleeps in a storage unit every night." "Isn't that a little dramatic?" I say. "If she really wanted to be dramatic, she could say she was living in a cardboard box in the street." "Oh no," I say, "that would be way too obvious." "A storage unit? That's Rebecca," I say. It is clear she does not know if I mean Rebecca the drug addict or Rebecca the overdramatic, the inventor, the conjurer. All I know is that she sleeps in a storage unit. "Or she says she sleeps in a storage unit," I say. "Do you believe her?" "What do I know? It's insane. It's just insane." I know that what this means is that in the "is she crazy or is she addicted" question, Anna has begun to lean toward the former. "What's she doing now?" "Washing off a face mask, I think." "When's the last time you saw her?" "A couple years ago," I say, "before the book came out." "Does she look crazy to you?" "She looks the same," I say. "I do not like that haircut," Anna says. "That haircut is a sign of something bad." I say nothing because I agree with her and I do not want her to know it. "I think this is going to be harder than we thought," she says. "All we need to do," I say, "is walk her into hospital in 36 hours. "I hope it's that easy." "Why shouldn't it be?" "Because she lives in a storage unit," she says, "because of what's happened. This isn't about anything but us doing a favor for her mom." "You don't believe her, do you?" "I believe that I have an apartment and you have a family and we both need to get back to them." I laugh, hoping Anna will say something before realizing how pathetic I sound. Clearly, the microwave must be terribly lonely. The George Foreman grill must weep. Rebecca is 25. Rebecca has been 25 for 5 years. "That's that," she had said, blowing out 25 candles on her birthday cake. And even in the filmy light seeping through the curtains at the IHOP next to the Radisson, it is clear that this is who she is, that she actually appears not to have aged, while Anna has stopped wearing sleeveless shirts and I have terrorized myself into not making facial expressions so as to prevent the need for plastic surgery I will not be able to afford. "Smile," Rebecca keeps saying through mouthfuls of pancakes, and I keep nodding in reply. We have given her the power to stop and start and manipulate time at her will, the artist's power of creating and stealing and shaping worlds at her whim. The world of my vocation is limited to things that actually happen that are true, one that would be more than enough if I had any ear for it. Anna has chosen to limit her world to one populated by rabbits. But Rebecca is the artist at this table, and we are the paints on her palette. What should we do now? Do you guys want to go to the auto racing museum? We have to go to the storage unit and pick up the things you want to take to the hospital, Anna says. I need to buy a hat, and then I have to go to work. Can you drive me? I usually walk. Work? What work? Anna is doing all of the talking. There is Anna in her little gunboat surveying the shore. I will stay here with the cowards and the cooks, back in the battleship, far from the coast. For Vic, she says. I told you about Vic. We have to go to Vic's at 3. Who is Vic? I told you about Vic, she says. I clean his house. But Rebecca, Anna says, exasperated but also wary. She has made it through the gunfire to the sands of a beach laden with landmines. You made $700,000 last year. No, I didn't. You did, I say, before Anna can say anything first. I read about it in the Post. There was an auction, and one publishing house decided to give you $700,000 for your story. There were taxes, she says. And, Anna says, I made $400,000 after taxes. So why are you cleaning houses? Because I clean houses every Tuesday and Friday from 3 to 10. But why? Because I like to. No, you don't, Anna says. Yes, I do. It's very peaceful. It's like Pilates. Here we are again. We are talking not to a friend, but to a character she's in the process of inventing, a house cleaning Pilates instructor. What are you talking about? I clean houses and I need to clean Vic's house. I don't understand this at all, Anna says. Now Rebecca is all pleading and pouts. Can't we please just go to Vic's? Rebecca is a cleaning woman. No, of course she isn't. Rebecca is on the cover of Poets and Writers and signed away her paperback rights for $700,000. She walks away from the table toward the bathroom, thinks of more lies, repositions herself as the heroine in another girl's story, another girl's life. Anna pulls out her cell phone and calls her husband. She smiles into her hands like she is salivating over something sweet, which she is. I hold mine in my hand beneath the table and visualize each of my friends, beseeching them to call. This faith in telepathy explains too much about my career as a science writer. Finally, a blue-smocked waitress approaches us with a check. I didn't want to come while she was still here, she says. Is that Rebecca Shanner, the writer? Anna nods her head yes, her blonde curls swinging forward and back. I thought so, she says. I knew it. I saw her reading at Borders. Was that story true, about being trapped in a well? It was true, I say, but it was a wall. Oh my God, what a fucked up story. I didn't go outside for a week after I read that story, she says, or at least a couple hours. She looks back to the kitchen and then to us, conspiratorially. Don't worry about the check, she says. I'll take care of it. Anna looks at the check and at me, and I see her look even though I am staring at the ceiling. For $13.11, she says, I would have preferred not to have had that conversation. Rebecca directs us to Vic's, where we drop her off, watching her disappear through the second floor door to a condominium. We make our way to a Quick Check, where we buy Pringles and Diet Coke, which we eat in the parking lot. Maybe it's OxyContin's, Anna says. I saw that on Dateline. They all do them out here. It's like OxyContin Central. They turn people into cleaning women? Maybe I saw it in 60 Minutes or 2020. There were all these high school kids with mullets, and one of them had a grandmother with cancer, and they'd steal all her pills. And they were all wearing denim jackets and denim shirts and jeans. They call it hillbilly heroin. And you think Vic is what? Her connection? Sure, right? Anna says. Maybe she spent $400,000 on prescription painkillers that she bought from Vic. Maybe he's a doctor or pharmacist, and now she's so addicted that he whores her out or something, on Tuesdays and Fridays from 3 to 10. I saw that Law and Order, I say. Andrew McCarthy was in it, but the girl was more like a Stockholm Syndrome sex slave. I didn't see that one, she says. I wish I'd seen that one. We're fucked, I say. Pretty much, Anna says. She is smoking now, and she opens the door, waving the smoke out of the car. You can't smoke in a rental car, I say. You're going to make me sneeze, but I don't. I wish I could go home to the George Foreman Grill. Maybe our best friend is getting $40 for a blowjob right now. Do you think that's how much you get? Anna says. On SVU, there was this one hooker getting 30, but she was like way older than Rebecca. I wish you would move back to Manhattan instead of hiding in Brooklyn so you could visit me and the kids, Anna says. I talk to you every other day, I say. But I mean like this, together, you never want to come into the city anymore. But I mean, I understand that, she says, quickly covering. She does not like to be unsure of her words, and she does not like not knowing her etiquette. Do you like your new apartment? I am the moon, a frozen accident of iron and magnesium. Rebecca is the Boston Celtics. This is her mother's metaphor. When Mrs. Shanner first called Anna 2 weeks ago to ask us to come home, she had made the same connection. A gifted but battered team, two starters out with injuries, had just fought their way back to advance to the top of the conference. It was at this point that the team, on the verge of a resurrection, collapsed, and now they are 10.5 games behind the Nets. This is the trouble with living metaphors. Mrs. Shanner keeps an eye on the television as she slices a bowl of kiwis into cubes. I do think she's doing drugs, Mrs. Shanner says. Something, it's not right the way she is right now. We can't force her to go, right? Anna says. She promised me that if you two went with her to the appointment, she would do what you said, Mrs. Shanner says. And if Dr. Chowdhury says she has to stay, she has to stay. I think she's smoking crack, Rebecca's sister Julie says. She is a fucking crack smoker. When have you ever seen a crack smoker? Anna says. We have crack smokers in Charlotte, Julie says. Julie, enough, Mrs. Shanner says. One of the Celtics goes for an easy layup but smacks the ball against the backboard and into an opposing player's hand. I'm just so glad you girls are here, Rebecca's mother says. Rebecca is a role model, one of a trio. Again, Anna and I fill the two open slots. The Naugatuck Observer ran a picture of the three of us, published writers all, taken at our 10-year high school reunion 2 years ago. Anna was 8 months pregnant, midway through a rabbit's life for me. Pass the lettuce, please. Rebecca had been shortlisted for a National Book Award, and I had just filed Cues from Capistrano, Notes on a Swallow's Return. There was talk of bringing us back to speak ensemble at graduation, but then a girl from the class ahead of us was cast in the sequel to a comic book franchise movie, and Rebecca lost the prize, and people from the school stopped calling. Rebecca is a role model in hip boots and rubber mitts, on her knees, a pail of dirty water at her side. Rebecca is the queen of the muse, Vic says, bowing down, pointing to her scrubbing his kitchen floor. Rebecca is the empress of the Ardennes. No, she is Cinderella, and we, her evil stepsisters, glowering from a plastic-covered leather sofa. I know what the muse is, Rebecca says, sing-song, pointing at a velvet rendition of a river above our heads. It appears to be one in a series of frame pictures hung throughout the living room. The other four display a forest and the ocean, and then a soldier in a gas mask, and a pair of what appear to be trenches dug into the dirt. Isn't Vic an amazing artist? Is it just World War I you depict in velvet? Anna says, not in her nice rabbit voice. The Great War, Vic sighs, the mother of all wars. Vic loves World War I, Rebecca says. We are the dead, he begins. I hate Vic. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders Field. Vic holds out his hand in some kind of modified salute toward the picture of the trenches. He makes a motion like he is wiping away a tear, but I am close enough to see that there is nothing there. I'm going to wait in the car, I say. Nothing bad has ever happened to Rebecca, but she is a writer and she must write what she knows. When what you know is fucking a bartender so you can live in his apartment without paying rent, that is pretty dramatic, but it is not enough. She loves these people who rub up against their misery, who are so glib in their poetry or their recitation of poetry or in their velvet paintings. It should not be allowed in so eagerly, but Rebecca loves it. No wonder she comes here, loves trying it on and parading in it and wearing it to the photo shoot for Newsweek, even when it is not hers, even when she is just borrowing it. Rebecca is a storyteller, and here is a story. Here is an image. There is a girl, and truly a girl, though I was 25 when it happened, in a pit, and by pit I mean a well, 10 feet in diameter, shallow enough that it is only twice my height again, and sunlight filtered through trees reaches midway down the hole by noon, two noons, and then three. Now here is the subtext, the psychological discourse. How did I get from there to here? There is an apartment with a doorman and a pool. Here is a pit and water up to my waist. But that was the fiction. The here was not there. The here was a closet in a neighbor's apartment. The there was only a few flights away. You're saying, how does a girl get locked in a closet? I say in return, do you not read the newspaper? Try this at parties. I was locked in a closet for 3 days by the man in 7A who wanted to save me from the men of New York. See what you get in return. He did not actually say, the men of New York. He said, will you watch Chipper while I go to the vet for some antibiotics? Once I bought a microwave at PC Richards & Sons, and while buying it, became friendly with the salesman. When I told him I was calling a cab to take my purchase home, he insisted that he drive me. He was getting off a shift, he said. I was on his way. It would save me $15. Idling at a red light on Flatbush Avenue, he told me that selling microwaves was his second job, a nights and weekends job, which supplemented the income he earned as a transit cop, which meant he had a gun in his glove compartment. So there I was, alone in a car, with a man and his gun, with a microwave on my lap. I told him to drop me off 5 blocks from my apartment and told him I was moving to Italy in 2 weeks, that the microwave was a present from my boyfriend. This is just to illustrate that when I used to say I had trust problems, they were not what you might have expected. He went to jail, 7A. He was not a criminal mastermind. You hear contempt in my voice, and I do have contempt for him, for being so inept. Closet walls are thin, and each dosage of gamma hydroxybutyrate, which is what I was told he added to my Diet Coke and then made me swallow at intervals, lasts only 4 hours. It was not until police unearthed the bodies of 5 other girls beneath the floorboards of his father's shop in Queens that I began to feel something I have identified as respect. It is not, I admit, as exotic as being taped up in blankets and dropped into an abyss, obscured by the undergrowth of a Connecticut forest. It does not allow for the play of shadow and light on the floors of a stone well constructed as a hiding place for escaped slaves moving north to Canada on the Underground Railroad. But it is a truth unvarnished. It is the only thing I talked about for 4 years. Some other girls I know remain mute, but not me. I stopped going to work, stopped eating, stopped walking alone after dark, before dark. Talking was something I continued to do. Night after night, and Rebecca, I believe, took notes. It is all hers, the artistry of it. I simply explained to her when to be terrified and when to be tired and when to be bored. She widened it, broadened it, made it a story of redemption, of triumph over adversity, a story of 3 girls from the country who suffer in the city and find solace in each other. There is one scene where we are young again, sitting on a river's bank beneath a full moon, and I think what she said was that our agape stilled the stars, which is a stupid thing to say, since stars are fixed, maybe in a local sense, but subject to galactic motion on a macro level. To still the stars would be to reach absolute zero, less a temperature than a state of being, the state in which matter is motionless. Absolute zero, metaphorically speaking, would come soon enough. Rebecca follows Anna out Vic's front door. She is wearing a blue hat with pom-poms, and even in the soft sodium light, I can see that she is frowning. Anna marches up to the car and slams the door shut. This really sucks, she says. Rebecca stands outside for a moment and then gets in the back. I'm starving, she says. Can we go back to IHOP? Rebecca, Anna says, we are extremely worried about you. I don't know why, she says. I'm fine. I'm awesome. I'm the awesomest. Rebecca is a hostess, the awesomest hostess. I want to show you guys everything, she says, hopping out of the car, skipping up to the gate of her unit and bouncing with excitement until she manages to lift it open. This is where I sleep, she says, pointing to a sheet folded in half on the concrete floor. There is a television and a DVD player and a stereo. It is 1/8 the size of my apartment, and yet here, no milk crates are being used as chairs or bookshelves or TV stands. Bunches of violets are tied together with twine and set in vases in front of a mirror. It is perfect and precise. It is Martha Stewart living in a storage unit. I got that at Pier 1, she says to Anna, who is stroking a velvet pouf positioned in front of the television. Can you believe I only pay $29 a month for this place? Why everyone in America isn't living in storage units, I just don't know. Anna and I are nodding. We agree. Her logic is undeniable. Why aren't Americans living in storage units? Where do you get your electricity from? Anna says, finally. Oh, from out there, Rebecca says. She waves her hand toward the door, the parking lot, the highway, the world. We see an extension cord snake beneath the door, but where it goes remains a mystery. Where do you pee? Anna says again. I don't pee at night, Rebecca says. Her brow is literally furrowed, and looking at it hurts, makes me push the skin above my eyebrows away from my nose, toward my ears, away from the area I will someday exhibit to the dermatologist. Who pees at night? I do, I say, wanting to help Anna out, wanting to establish a case against living in a storage unit. Well, that must be because you drink at night, Rebecca says. That is that. I pack some things up, she says, pointing to two shoeboxes. One is filled with a half dozen bags of dried fruit, and the other with a pair of Manolo Blahnik slingbacks. You two take these into the car and wait for me while I tidy up. Oh, and this. She hands us a quilted makeup bag the size of a small dog. This is extremely, extremely important. Okay, Anna says. Now go to the car, Rebecca says. I have things to do. Anna in the passenger seat turns on the radio. The parking lot is situated at the top of a hill, and below us is a soft, rolling valley. It looks like a paint-by-numbers countryside. Anna opens her window, and we can smell trash burning and hear the sound of a racetrack in the distance. It is beautiful. My family only moved here when I was 16, when my father, a physics professor, was made head of the department at the university. I wish we had time to go see NASCAR, I say. Don't you feel like we're missing something, not going to a NASCAR thing? At least we know what she spent her money on, Anna says, holding the shoes up on one finger, regarding them with the fine concentration of a farmer examining a newborn lamb. These are $700 shoes. I still have the dried fruit on my lap. Do you want some apricots? Anna shakes her head and points to the quilted bag. What do you think's in there? Her crack pipe? We should go through it. Do you think so? Anna is already pulling out hair conditioner, blue eyeliner, a kelp mask, echinacea, St. John's wort. It's a kind of drug, I say. My brother-in-law, Polly, would identify that as a nutraceutical. Strawberry massage oil, carrot lip balm, a half dozen old film canisters. Anna takes one and shakes it. What's that? Anna pops off the gray lid and empties the contents into her palm. What are those, I say. How do I know? Should we take them to a pharmacist? Polly is a drug dealer, I say. Maybe he can tell us what they're for. He's not really a drug dealer, Anna says. Is he? I call the person who makes the ecstasy that the drug dealers sell a drug dealer. Do you realize there's like five different pills in here? Anna says, separating them by color and size. There's just one. That's just one, and there are like six of these film things. And these, she says, pointing to three plain black ones. These are definitely not medically sanctioned. Do you want me to call him? I think I do, Anna says. I pull out my cell phone and dial my sister's number in Massachusetts. Mindy, I say, I need to ask Polly some drug questions. Silence. Why would Mindy? Silence. Why would Polly know anything about drugs? Mindy, I say. Are you in a cell phone, she says. Do you know the government monitors cell calls? Mindy, please. Polly has a doctorate in physics, just like Daddy. Polly does important research for a German pharmaceutical company. Jesus Christ, Mindy, I just need to ask him something. While she is silent, I hear the television in the background. Someone has bought an O. Are you okay? She says. Are you calling me from inside a closet? Mindy, this is my family. Here is a scientific fact for you. There is a medical disorder called Packett's disease, where something like oversized boils form beneath the skin, completely invisible to the eye, and every once in a while, these boils will just burst without any warning. This is my family. Everything looks normal, average, suburban, and then something poisoned but not malignant, something the body simply cannot process on its own, will just pop out. God damn it, Mindy. Jesus, show some concern and see what you get, she says. Hold on. Someone on Mindy's kitchen counter television has just won $2,700, having suggested Orange County as the mystery word. Polly Goodman here, my brother-in-law says. If you found five black pills without any marking or writing or anything on them, what would you think they were? Did I find these in a lab or on the bathroom floor of a bar? In the makeup bag of someone we suspect of having a drug problem. Well, Polly says, how do I know? It could be anything. Anything produced in pill form. Okay, I say. And Anna is poking me in the arm. By anything, I mean anything illegal, he says. Anything legit, probably, who knows, but probably would be stamped with identifying information. I figured, I say. What? Anna whispers. If you want to bring it over, I can take a look, he says. Without seeing it, I mean, who knows? You're talking ecstasy, MDMA, the so-called date rape drugs. Like gamma hydroxybutyrate, I say. Yeah, Polly says. Don't let anyone put that in your Diet Coke or anything. Bop. Oh, families. I love the fiction of the well-spoken families who, upon recovering a loved one from a critical situation, quote Keats and make waffles. It is not like that. It is like a giant baboon has attached himself to your ankle in the dining room and it is shitting on the table. And though they understand that it is not your fault that a baboon has attached himself to your ankle, this baboon is nonetheless shitting on the on the dining room table. Anna is shaking my knee with her hand, not like a mother, but like her 2-year-old daughter. Thanks, Polly, I say, and return to the crisis at hand. Rebecca wants a candy bar. I want a candy bar now. She was talking about velvet paintings, a wonderful medium velvet with such subtle textures and rich colors. And now she is screaming, and Anna, driving, signals into the travel lane and opens her window. Rebecca pulls my hair so hard that the back of my head is pinned to the seat. Jesus, Rebecca! I want a goddamn candy bar now! Or what, I say, or you're going to write about it? There, that is my best shot. That is my best shot at scraping open this wound so she can fix it. What are you talking about, she says, and I honestly believe she does not know what I am talking about. You made $400,000 thanks to me, so go buy your own fucking candy bar. Are you mad about that, she says. I cannot say anything. Are you? This is fucking asinine, I say to Anna. Can you take the exit and get her to a gas station? Rebecca sits quietly in the back seat until we pull into an Exxon parking lot and I get out and buy her a Snickers bar. Here you go, I say. Rebecca keeps the car in park. Rebecca unwraps her candy bar. Thanks, she says. I love Snickers. Is there anything else you want to say to her? Anna says to Rebecca. Were you really mad about that thing with the book? I want to go back to the hotel and go to sleep, I say to Anna. She grants me the first but cannot help with the second, and I spend the night in the bathroom, sitting on the toilet lid, adrenaline coursing through my body, looking and wishing for someone to fight. Rebecca apparently is Jackie Onassis. While Anna spoke to her mother and I had IHOP deliver a stack of buttermilk pancakes, watching them walk the plastic bag across the parking lot, Rebecca changed into a pink pantsuit, white gloves with a 1/4-inch ruffle, appropriate for luncheons and drug tests. I didn't know this was a formal occasion, I say, although I suspected it. She is a princess of Saxony, bidding farewell before exile. Adieu, adieu. Or au Wiedersehen, but better in the French. She should be wearing Chanel. Maybe she is wearing Chanel. $400,000 went somewhere if it didn't go up her nose. Up her nose. I think that, and all it means is that I don't know what to think, that I am lacking the words to express my situation, to describe my surroundings without relying on the obvious. The pantsuit, this hotel room, and the polyester bedspread, the framed floral prints. Rebecca would not set a scene in as anonymous a place as this. It would be transmuted, rendered in gold silks and purple satins. I am overreaching, probably, again. Rebecca would find the grace in something simple, something in gray and green cottons. Rebecca would know what to say, what to think. Do you guys want to go to the auto racing museum before we go to the hospital? She says, sitting on the edge of the bed. It's only 30 miles from here. Or not. Maybe she is losing her words, her knowing what to say, because she is smoking crack, and this is God's way of punishing her for telling my story and smoking crack, not for stealing my story, which would be self-serving and satisfactory. We only have a couple hours before we're supposed to be at your doctor, Anna says. Do you want to go see where the Panthers play? I really think we should just hang out here for a while and go to the hospital, Anna says. Maybe you want to see where Dawson's Creek was filmed? It's pretty far to Wilmington, but I've never seen it before. Or we could get some breakfast? You know you're not supposed to eat anything, Anna says. I know. You didn't have anything to eat this morning, did you? You didn't have any pancakes. I just said no, didn't I? You didn't go to the vending machine and get candy or potato chips or anything? This is stupid, Rebecca says tightly. I thought we were going to have fun while you were here, and you're just bossing me around like my mom. I'm not your mom, Anna says. I know that, do you? "You're being a brat," Anna says, and I know this voice from listening to her reprimand her daughters. "I don't want to deal with a brat this morning." Rebecca sits heavily on one of the twin beds. Anna presses her palm against the window and to her face, leaving handprints on the glass. "I think we should just sit here in silence until we leave for the hospital," I say, and that is exactly what we do. The waiting room has a television set, and Anna and I watch an hour of CNN, an hour of earthquakes and factory shootings and murdering teenagers, which has the combined effect of a sedative, of perspective. "How long do you think this is going to take?" I say, during a commercial for the Patrick Stewart version of A Christmas Carol. "You think she's making this up," Anna says. "I think she needs to write another book, and your husband's still breathing." "We can't make this be about that," she says. "Wait until she writes a bestseller about your husband fucking a secretary, and we'll see what you say then." "My husband doesn't have a secretary," Anna says. "I know," I say. "That's why I use it as an example, so it wouldn't be hurtful." "I'm not saying this isn't something you guys need to work out. I'm just saying we can only handle one emergency at a time." "What are you talking about? Do you know where we're taking her? It's probably a fucking spa. She probably gets massages every day and eats pepper crusted salmon every night." "I don't think so," Anna says. "She's going to call us every night and tell us how she had to choose between steak and pan-seared scallops," I say, "and how many hot guys are in all her rehab meetings." I am still scowling when a nurse approaches us. "Are you the girls with Rebecca Shanner?" she says. "Dr. Chowdhury would like to speak with you." I lead the way into the office, clutching a clipboard to my chest. I am a woman of science. I have received a press release on the efficacy of various methods of drug treatments. I have written a story on a heroin-like substance that bees secrete through their tails. Anna looks small, inconsequential. I do not want to lead. I would prefer to continue following. I wish we were visiting one of Anna's domains, a petting zoo or a rabbit farm. We sit in two leather chairs. Are there always two? Is this the designated number for concerned relatives and friends? And I train my gaze on my clipboard, but the top sheet is an overdue electric bill, which does not suggest the correspondence of a woman of science. And instead of studying it, I turn it over on my lap and rest my elbows on it, my chin on my hands. Dr. Chowdhury is magisterial in his procession from the door to the chair behind his desk, his posture so pronounced that he walks with the physical rigor of a peasant carrying a pail of water on his head. He passes in front of a bookshelf lined with medical texts, books I discovered can be rented by television show production designers, outfitting a fictional doctor's office. I try to devise a way to open our discussion with this tidbit. "So," I say. Dr. Chowdhury does not look up from the papers on his desk. "Where are Rebecca's parents?" "Her father's in the military in Germany," Anna says. "And her mother asked us to take care of us, to bring her by." "I've talked to her mother, but only briefly, and Rebecca asked that I discuss this with you and not her," he says. "How aware are you of her current situation?" "Her situation," Anna says. "You mean living in the storage unit?" "We know about that," I say. "That's unusual, no?" Dr. Chowdhury says. "She's eccentric," Anna says. "I've spoken to Rebecca about this, and she asked that I inform you both of exactly what's happening to her," he says. "Do the two of you understand that Rebecca is currently being treated for?" He says a word I do not know. Neither of us knows, so we ask him to spell it, which he does. "What is that?" Anna says. "You could call it a degenerative brain disease," he says. Nothing. The vastness and silence of space, the space between Uranus and Pluto and the space in this office are identical. Dr. Chowdhury clasps his hands behind his peppermint striped shirt and leans back in his chair as Anna and I look at each other. "Like Alzheimer's?" I ask her. "Not as bad," Dr. Chowdhury says. "It can be managed to some extent, some of the damage held off." "But she'll die from it?" "We'll all die from something," he says, touching the tips of his fingers to each other. "This disease will likely play a role in Rebecca's death at some point. It's incredibly rare in someone this age. She's been phenomenally unlucky." "That's impossible," Anna says. "It's a bad haircut. That's it." "Delusions, paranoia, unpredictability," the doctor says. "Those are classic symptoms." "She's not that sick," Anna says. "I mean, we just assumed she was taking a lot of drugs." "Or faking," I say. "She's not faking," Dr. Chowdhury says. You don't know Rebecca, I say. She's always doing stuff like this. I know about stuff like this, Anna says. I've read about mistaken diagnoses and giving teenagers Ritalin and how you can't wait to diagnose people with extremely expensive illnesses. I assure you that that is not the case here, Dr. Chaudhry says. How long has this been going on? A few months, he says. She's just eccentric, Anna says, sniffling. She turns to me. This is what happens when you seek medical advice in the South. What you're seeing now, this eccentricity, is a symptom of a larger problem and a poorly managed medication program. What do you mean, poorly managed? Anna says. Why wouldn't she stay on her medication? She said she couldn't think clearly, that she couldn't work. Would that be true? With a situation like this, it's difficult to say what exactly caused her cloudiness, what the medication is responsible for, and what's actually due to the underlying disorder. She's just eccentric, Anna says again. She may also be eccentric, he says, but that is unfortunately not what we are discussing here today. Anna looks at me, and I know she hears it too, the even modulation in his voice, as measured as a Bach sonata. There is nothing new in this for him except a name and a set of faces, a pair of creased brows he must soothe into acquiescence sufficient that they will exit his office. And for your records, my medical degree is from the University of Chicago, which is where I spent nearly a decade in private practice. That's mean, I say. You didn't need to say that. I apologize, he says, and he looks for a second like he means it. Shouldn't she understand how bad this is? Shouldn't she want to take her medicine? Anna again. It's fairly common for patients to have an impaired awareness of their own illness. Again, I can hear the copyright in his voice. Many patients will respond to medication, and many of them can hope to degree some degree, and many of them can hope to maintain some degree of independence at this phase of the illness. Can hope to? What does that mean? That she lives in a hospital forever? There is a despair in Anna's voice that breaks in the air like ice. Doesn't someone need to tell her mom? At this point, that remains Rebecca's decision. What happens to her now? We're going to keep her here for a day and reinstall her treatment program. Reinstall. Here is the entryway to a new lexicon, the lexicon we will use to discuss Rebecca. Drosophila, recombinance, vermilion eye color, gamma hydroxybutyrate, mitochondrial DNA, green bottle flies, tunneling into the bodies of all those dead girls and queens. So many little forests made up of so many different words. So much science I don't understand. When it says on the TV show that someone is senile, what's wrong with them? Now I have something to say, and it is extremely, extremely stupid. Women of science. Is that what this is? Dr. Chaudhry looks at his wrists, at his University of Chicago cufflinks, and thinks, why? Why did I ever leave research? Why did I ever walk out of that ivory tower glimmering in the morning sun? That could refer to any number of disorders, he says, and I can see him, thinking of the research assistants, the way they would wear so little beneath their lab coats, the way they would touch their tongue to their lips when they tried to assess the level of fatigue research participants would experience while completing the department's internet surveys. Women of science. Rebecca is waiting for us outside Dr. Chaudhry's office, pink pillbox hat resting on her knees, legs crossed at the ankles. So he told you, she says. It's okay. I told him he could tell you. I just told him he couldn't tell my mom. That is like beyond. Rebecca, Anna starts. This is so not a big deal, she says. Everyone interesting these days has some kind of disorder. Rebecca is sick, and now that is all there is to know. Rebecca is sick, and now, for me, that is all there is to know about Rebecca. I know. I am being reductive. Patient advocacy groups would protest my view. But 2 hours ago, there was a mass in my chest like a sack of flour on my lap, and I just hit a wall going 200 miles an hour, and it is both everywhere and utterly gone. I am breathing it in, but I cannot see it or feel it. What changes when someone is sick? How much is forgiven? Anna is standing in front of the health and sexuality section of the Barnes & Noble 3 blocks from the hospital, stacking medical books under her arm. In this hard light, I can see streaks of dried tears tracking from her eyes to her jaw. I feel like we're living in an episode of Oprah, she says. That is a feeling I am familiar with, I say. Is this what it was like after? That was worse, I say automatically. This is worse. I don't know. Rebecca is a thief. Rebecca is sick. These are inseparable weights on a balance. Rebecca is my friend. The first night I spent away from my parents, I spent at her house, and she walked me home after we watched Annie, and I became convinced my parents had died in a fire. She'll be okay, I say. Don't say that, Anna says, because you know it's not true. She starts to cry again. I don't know why such fucked up things happen to the people I know. Now you have a story you can write about her and you'll be even. No, I say, I'm not her biographer. I say that and I mean it, and because I am not the kind of person who always means what she says, because I am the kind of person who speaks loosely, I am stopped by them. I am stilled. I am not an artist. I am not immortal. I am not a woman of science, though maybe I will be. Maybe I'll move to Hawaii and study the sea. I am the victim of a stranger abduction and a newspaper reporter who is bad at her job. I am the owner of a George Foreman grill, but I would not trade her for her place, and I did not know. But I would not trade for her place, and I did not know that before. It is not fair or good, but it is as inevitable as a chemical reaction, as oxygen and iron turning to rust. I believe you know that she is invincible, immortal. This is the only lens I have for her. This will not end in this dead, ugly hospital, but in another suburban bookstore, and every journalist who interviews her will, instead, begin there. I am just playing the supporting role I was given. She'll prove my loyalty with the scene about the candy bars, or maybe not. Maybe there was some other telling detail, one I missed. She's the genius. Maybe she'll call me Mandy or Mirabelle. Mandy. I have always wanted to be a Mandy. Even now I can say it, see it. The unity of time and place and purpose, the perfect arc of it, the balance, the harmony, like a rainbow over a meadow. Rebecca. Rebecca would never involve a rainbow in a metaphor. She'll write it herself, I say, and get twice the money and three times the press. Maybe I'll write it, Anna says. Whether she realizes it or not, she sticks out her chin, a gesture of resolution that resembles nothing so much as a profile on a coin. It will be a heartwarming tribute. Harvey at the hospital. Rabbits on meds. Her chin begins to quiver. Anna and I are moving in opposite directions. Maybe at this moment we are level, but it is only because I started out so far below. I am expanding, rising, and she is contracting, sinking. We are the same elements in two different states. She'll tell it herself, I say. No, Anna says, with a mother's irreducible, unavoidable grief, and I am taken aback with the physical force of it. No, I don't think so. She won't.